Good afternoon. My name is Bob Griffin. I'm the Chief Executive Officer of IOSD. I want to just take a minute to thank Clark again for putting on what is a fabulous event here. For those of you that have been coming to this forum on a regular basis, as I have, these are the types of things that I think are critical for maintaining our civil society and our own norms. So I want to thank him again publicly for the work he's doing. Well, we talked earlier about co-equal branches of government. So this next panel, I think, is going to really drive the importance of that point home very quickly here. This is a panel entitled Congress's Role in Making an Execution of National Security Policy in the Trump Era. It'll be moderated by Ryan Leza. For those of you that don't know Ryan, he covers the White House, Congress, national politics, and elections for The New Yorker, and he's also an on-air political contributor for CNN. So with that, Ryan.
Hey, thank you very much. Thanks to the Aspen Institute and to Clark and Walter for having me back. We have a very distinguished panel of a bipartisan panel. Start with Michael McCaul, the chairman of the Homeland Security Committee. Stephanie Murphy, one of the newest members of Congress. And first of all, I should say, Congressman McCaul is a Republican from Texas. Stephanie Murphy, one of the newest members of Congress, a Democrat from Florida, who's previously worked at the Department of Defense. And Adam Schiff, the ranking member of the House Intelligence Committee and a Democrat from California. And another Republican from Texas. You guys in Texas produce a lot of Republican representatives. And the chairman of the House Armed Services Committee. I feel like we're at that point in the conference where everything has been said, but not everybody has said it, especially on Russia. So I hope we can, you know, plow some new ground. And I want to start with that topic, because there is so much, maybe drama is the word, between Congress and the White House over this very fraught issue of Russia, both within the Republican Party and especially between the Democratic Party and the White House. And I want to start with a hypothetical. All of you have run for office, have been in tough campaigns against tough opponents. And I want each of you to answer this question. If you received an email from an acquaintance that said, I've got some really high-level and sensitive information from the Russian government, which, as you know, supports your campaign, would you like to set up a meeting? What would you do? Let's start at the end. Congressman McCaul?
It's a tough question. I think you obviously want to know all the information out there, but I think the optics of meeting with a foreign adversary or an agent of a foreign power or a lawyer who may have been a Russian intelligence operative creates a not only legal sort of issue, but a political optics issue. And just knowing what Russia's done in the past, what they did in our elections. So the question is, that meeting that you're referring to, was that, were they sort of duped by the Russians? Or was this more of a collusion type of event?
But would you take that meeting?
I'd have my campaign manager do it.
You would?
Or maybe my Oppo research guy. No, I think there'd probably be other ways to get that information without sitting down with someone that is that radioactive.
Congressman Murphy?
You know, when I worked at the Department of Defense, I filled out the SF-86. I waited a long time to get my TSSEI. I've been trained on counterintel methods. I understand the importance of reporting when you do have contact with foreign nationals, especially ones that are hostile to the United States. So I think my radar is a bit more up than my colleague. But what I will say about this coming election is that I want to run a race against a fellow American about issues that matter to my district, not run a campaign against a Russian misinformation. I think it's a really dangerous thing when we allow an external foreign force into meddling in our democracy.
Would you call the FBI? What would you do?
Yeah, probably call somebody like the FBI and reach out. I mean, I just can't imagine taking that meeting.
Adam?
I'd call the FBI and report it and leave it to the FBI what to do about it. But I wouldn't take the meeting, and I would immediately notify law enforcement. You know, the only analogy I can give, and it's not much of an analogy, is about a decade ago when I was on the Foreign Affairs Committee, the Russian ambassador came to my office. And
you're a member of this meeting.
I do.
Russian ambassadors are famously known for not being memorable.
And what I did is I called the Capitol Police, and they came and they swept my office for bugs. Now, this, I think, predated my service on the Intelligence Committee, but nonetheless, not only I, but the Capitol Police had enough skepticism about Russian intentions to know that we needed to make sure that the visitor did not leave anything behind. So I think absolutely. And you know, what I keep, you know, coming back to is something President Obama said when he did finally speak publicly about the Russian hacking. And he said that what made the Russian hack so successful, what made this active measures campaign successful beyond Moscow's wildest imagination, is that it could play on the enormous political divide in the country. And there was enough of a ideological and political and partisan divide where it was okay that a foreign adversary was intervening as long as it was to help one side and hurt the other. And somehow we're going to have to develop a bipartisan consensus that no matter what country it is, no matter who it helps or who it hurts, we will reject it, any kind of interference, help, hurt, otherwise. Because I can tell you, the Russians are good enough at this. They have a capable enough cyber skills. There is no software patch, no software fix to this. We need to harden our defenses, yes, but the only real defense is a public that's willing to reject it. And we have a long way to go to get to that point.
I want to come back to that issue of partisanship, because I think that's crucial. But Congressman Thornberry?
I'm old school when it comes to Russia, kind of like Clapper. So I call the FBI. I don't trust them on as far as I could film. What I worry about is goes back to the word you used in your question, and that is the drama. This is so much drama that occupies us. Meanwhile, as we heard earlier today, the Russians are modernizing their nukes. They have counter space capability. They are developing new weapons. They're about to conduct big exercises in Belarus. Yeah. They are doing all of these things, and meanwhile, we're worried about the drama of who met who with whom.
Yeah.
Part of our job as an independent branch of government is keep our eye on the ball, in this case, the threats that Russia poses to the national security of the United States, and don't get so caught up in the drama that we lose sight of those things that Adam was just talking about and the broader Russian threat.
And isn't that part of the success of their campaign last year?
Yeah, and
is
we
that
fall
it
for
dominates
it.
Our
yeah,
conversations,
and we
right? In the old days of the Soviet Union, they would exploit maybe our lack of full commitment to civil rights or support for dictatorships abroad. Now what they've discovered is one of our great weaknesses is our polarization, our partisanship, that if they can help one side against the other, it might be so tempting to take that help, and it throws the whole system and the whole conversation to chaos. We don't even get to the issues you're discussing.
No, and they exploit opportunities. And I think somebody earlier today, I forget, made that exact point. They're doing it very well. But again, to repeat myself, we see this, and yet we fall for it anyway. We better look at this broader picture because, as General Dumford and others said, this is at least the biggest threat to the national security of the United States.
Congressman Schiff, I want you to respond to this, because as someone who speaks a lot about this issue and the really micro details of what relationships the Russians and the Trump campaign may or may not have had, and is obviously on a committee running an investigation, is that a fair point? Do we spend too much time on this issue at the exclusion of other big ones?
You know, I don't think we spend too much time on it because, in particular, if there's any potential that the administration could be compromised, that's obviously a deep national security threat to the country. But I completely agree with Mac's point, which is we need to view this through the broader perspective of what Russia is doing. And what I always try to come back to when I talk about the investigation, why the investigation matters, the broadest perspective here, from my point of view, is we're engaged in a real ideological struggle with Russia right now. It isn't communism versus capitalism, but it is authoritarianism versus democracy and representative government. We see, looking at this objectively around the world, a real rise of the autocrats. Putin, I think, is in the vanguard of this, but you see it in Erdogan in Turkey and al-Sisi in Egypt and Duterte in the Philippines. You see it in Hungary and Poland. And there's a real challenge to the very idea of liberal democracy, an effort to tear down liberal democracy. What we saw in our elections, the Russians have been doing elsewhere. And we need to view this in the broader context of what the Russians are trying to do and the importance of our standing up and resisting that, working with our allies to resist Russian interference in their democracies, because this is the broader fight that I believe we're in.
It's all about destabilization. I got back from France after their election. They were clearly involved, but the French people didn't buy it because they knew it was Russia, talking about Macron. Yeah. Then I was in Estonia and Ukraine, heavy campaign disinformation warfare, in addition to kinetic warfare, annexing Crimea, being in eastern Ukraine. They tried to do it in our elections as well. I got the Gang of Eight briefing. I said at the time that we ought to call Russia out for what they're doing and that we have to have consequences to that. Legislatively, if you look at the Congress, we are working through a Russia sanctions package to punish Russia for both Crimea, but also their meddling in our elections.
I wanted to stop you there and tell us about the Gang of Eight briefing you're referring to and what the decision was that came out of that briefing by the administration.
Well, not to get into the classified space, but it was very clear.
The timing was what?
It was around the October timeframe before the election. It was not a gray, as Adam and Mac knows. This is not gray. It was black and white. Clear and convincing that this was on behalf of the Russian military and their intelligence apparatus. It was very shocking at the time. And I think part of the thinking at the time not to go public was because they didn't want it to appear to be influencing the elections or recognizing that Russia was doing this because it would embolden and empower them. Since that time, though, I think it's imperative that Congress act on the sanctions bill.
Wait, but I just wanted to keep on this subject. The way that this has been reported publicly is that the Obama administration wanted to do more in public, and the resistance came because of this partisanship we're talking about, that McConnell and some Republicans said, no, wait a second, don't do that. That could tip the election towards Hillary Clinton, and we would consider that interfering with the election. Is that your understanding of how that happened?
And well, I was in a classified setting, so I can just tell you from my perspective what I said, and that was we should call them out very clearly, because it wasn't kind of an iffy gray area, and I haven't seen real consequence in the whole cyber arena too.
Yeah.
What was the consequence to China stealing 20 million security clearances? You know, I was in Tom Bossert's office in the Situation Room talking about. What can we do in the future to stop that kind of bad behavior from North Korea, from Iran, from China and Russia?
Mac, when Democrats say the reason Obama didn't take stronger measures, didn't go more public, was because Republicans wouldn't let him, is there any credence to that?
I don't know that to be the fact.
No. Adam?
And Ryan, I don't agree with that either. I think two separate issues are being commingled here.
Yeah.
One issue at the time was letting the state elections officials know that they were vulnerable, that they ought to seek out help from the Department of Homeland Security.
Yeah.
And Director Clapper was exactly right. There was resistance to doing that, in part out of a fear that this was an effort to federalize elections, in part because I think there was a concern that this might have an impact on the election, I think a GOP concern about that. But obviously, that was a concern the Obama administration had, too, for the opposite reason. It didn't want to be perceived as putting its hand on the scale. But from my point of view, nothing overcame the American people's need to know. And Senator Feinstein and I tried to make the case with the administration, you need to speak out early. You need to speak out strongly on this. You need to call out the Russians on this. And much as I admire the prior administration, I think it was a mistake not to.
Yeah.
Senator Feinstein and I ultimately did so ourselves before our own administration was willing to. But I still don't think, frankly, we have done enough. And After the election, we did speak out through our administration. We did impose some sanctions. The sanctions have not been enough, and we're now facing a prospect that the president may even undermine the sanctions that were imposed as relatively minor as they were. But probably the most destructive thing from my point of view in terms of our preparedness is because I think the answer is reaching a national consensus about rejecting foreign intervention, that has to begin with the president acknowledging what happened. And it requires the president to say to the country, this is what we know took place, this is how we're going to protect ourselves going forward, and to put that in motion. But that hasn't happened. And it simply has to. We need to do whatever we can from the cyber perspective, but the most important thing, I think, is preparing the public, because as both directors just told us, this is going to be played out not only here but elsewhere, all around the world, not just by Russia either. You see the effect of cyber hacking in the explosion within the Gulf states right now. You see potential and allegations of cyber actions between Pakistan and India. You're going to see this now around the world as a very effective, very inexpensive way to meddle, to influence the affairs of others. And we need to prepare ourselves, and I do not think we're doing anything like we need to.
And, you know, I wasn't here last year when some of the revelations were made, but I'll tell you the way that my concern is that MAC led a delegation overseas to Asia recently, and the feedback we got from one of our top defense counterparts, they said to us, you know, watching the way that the United States is responding to this interference in our election and our democracy and the partisan nature of it, they said to us, you know, it doesn't appear that the United States is willing to defend its own democracy. What assurances do we have that you're going to help us defend ours? And I think that, to me, is the biggest concern. It's an internal and external threat. It's an internal threat to our own democracy, but it also opens us up because our adversaries and our allies are watching the way we respond to this, and it says a lot about our will, and I'm concerned about that.
Does anyone on this panel have any doubts about the consensus views of the intelligence community with respect to the Russian active measures campaign last year?
No.
I think I know Adam's view on this, but for the rest of you, how do you view the president's repeated undermining of that report? Let's start with you, Michael.
Well, I think...
Because you agree with those conclusions. You've read the classified version, right?
Personally, have told him that this was a nation-state attack.
What did he say?
At that time, it was prior to some of his briefings. He thought he wasn't sure. Thought it may be China, perhaps. But I think since that time, he's had the briefings. I think from his point of view, not to really defend it, but it sort of undermines the legitimacy of his election. And I think that's what's troubling him to come out and say definitively it was Russia. So he'll say, yeah, it probably was Russia, but it could have been China and some other actors. The sooner he says it's Russia, sooner we can move forward with this.
I mean, he has said it, but then he'll take it back. He sort of moves a couple of steps forward and then one step back.
Right.
What is your view of that and the president's inability to 100% embrace what everyone else in your world seems to agree on?
I don't know.
it's a very honest
That's answer. The most honest answer I've seen today.
Well, I don't know. A couple of bigger trends play into this. One is the trend in politics and maybe our society in general to see your own truth. I think General Hayden mentioned this earlier this morning about the challenge in knowing what is true and staying with what is true, even if it's contrary to your preconceived notions. We tend to seek out media that conforms to what we already believe. Mm-hmm. And so you extend this through social media and everything. You've got this thing throughout our society. And you know, whatever else one may say about the president, he excelled at using social media to win his election. But there are characteristics of that seem to me to be troubling throughout the society. The other point, I think it's just important to emphasize, getting back to some things Adam said, we have essentially another domain of warfare now. In addition to the traditional ones, we have cyber, we have outer space, and we also have, separate from cyber, this influence operation. It's not just the Russians. The Chinese do it. The Iranians do it. And so we have a different form of warfare attempting to advance your national goals for which we are not very well prepared to respond. And that's a challenge for our whole system.
And to my, this is nothing new. I prosecuted the Johnny Chung case, led us to the director of Chinese intelligence, putting money into the Clinton campaign.
Yeah.
So they, I mean, and Russia's been doing this with their, you know, spies, and they just have a new tool, and it's a cyberspace.
Do you think that 2016 was unique and sort of a quantum leap ahead of what had been tried and successfully done in previous elections?
With respect to cyber, it was
And I think the point was made earlier today, because they stole the information, but how they used it. But we should not think it's unique. Right. It's just the next step on the ladder.
The dumping.
Well, and I think part of the reason why our response was took as long in coming as it did is that it began the way I think most of the foreign intrusions we've seen in prior elections began, and that is it looked a lot like a foreign intelligence gathering operation. It looked like this is the Russians wanting to find out about people who might become president of the United States. That is something, regrettably, we expect not only of the Russians but of others. But at some point, the Russians decided to weaponize the data that they had gathered. Now, that was unprecedented, not for Europe, but it was unprecedented here. It demonstrated a whole new willingness of Russia to take on the most powerful nation on Earth in a quite a blatant way.
Yeah.
And so I think this is fundamentally different. I have to say I was disappointed to hear our CIA director minimize it by saying, well, yes, we've had this election after election. Certainly, we've had other instances of foreign intervention to some degree and foreign intelligence gathering. We have never seen anything like this before, and I don't think we should understate the significance of what just happened. It was a real violation of our sovereignty, and I share Director Brennan's upset over our president saying that he was really proud to meet Putin. And frankly, I'll go beyond that. I don't know what kind of a negotiator goes into that meeting by asking the adversary, did you do it? You go into that meeting saying, we know you did it, and here are the consequences, and you only seen the beginning of them. Yeah. And if you do it again, it's going to be far more serious. So, I do think we were slow to appreciate what the Russians were doing, but this was of a whole new order of magnitude that we did not anticipate, and obviously it's been quite devastating.
I want to ask a question about oversight and your role in oversight. When you are a Democrat with a Republican president, I think it's pretty clear oversight. It's simple what your role is. When you're the head of a Republican, when you're a Republican running a committee, and your own party is in power in the White House, things get more complicated immediately. I imagine your oversight role was a whole lot easier during the Obama years than it is the last 6 months with Trump. And I want to talk about this with respect to the investigation and what's been in the news this week with respect to Trump's relationship with his Justice Department and the special counsel. I was thinking about this today when Sean Spicer resigned. I mean, I could have thought of many reasons why someone in the Trump White House might have resigned in the last 6 months. For Sean, the sort of last straw was he got a new boss he didn't like. For you guys, especially the Republicans on the panel, what is that red line? What is the thing that President Trump would do with respect to this investigation where you would say, wait a second, that's too far, I need to do X? Is it firing Mueller? Is it not cooperating with the special counsel? Where are those red lines right now? Let's start with you.
If you're expecting me to predict everything that President Trump may do and what our reaction could be, I can't.
Well, let me be specific. What if he fired Mueller?
Yeah. We'll take it, whatever events come as they come. But I want to get back to your broader...
answering that, if you're the president sitting in the White House, you're saying, wait a second, a chairman of an important committee in Congress just said He's not sure if it's okay for me to fire Mueller or not. Doesn't that give him an inch to say, yeah, maybe I can do it?
No. It says I'm not going to answer hypotheticals about what might happen if.
Well, what if he shot someone on Fifth Avenue?
Yeah, well, he's talked about that.
No, but what if he did it? That's a hypothetical. If he shot someone, you would be for it or against it?
Well, it might depend on who it is. if it's Putin or Baghdadi, I might be somewhat sympathetic.
But there are actions that the president took which you would disagree with.
Yeah.
But firing the special counsel, you're not prepared to say that that's...
I'm not prepared to say anything that this event, not knowing the circumstances, provokes reaction X.
Okay.
But I want to get back to your bigger point.
Yeah.
And that one of the lessons I took that we did not do as well in the Bush administration as we should have is ask the hard questions.
Yeah.
Press them on the strategy in Iraq for reconstruction or whatever. Yeah. That does not necessarily mean that I disagree with any of the decisions, but I think it's our job as an independent branch of government, even when it's our party, to ask those difficult questions, partly as a representative of the American people, but partly because they're going to be better if they have to answer our questions, even as General Clapper referenced earlier, he doesn't like it sometimes. There's a tension and between the two branches that makes our system work. And that does put an onus on our shoulders, especially Republican shoulders in these days, to conduct that fair but tough oversight of administration actions. That's different from answering hypotheticals about what might happen if. It's talking about, okay, their military strategy for Afghanistan today, as we were talking about earlier, what is that?
Michael, I want to ask you, because you said today on NBC, I believe, that there would be, quote, a tremendous backlash if Trump fired Mueller. One of your colleagues seems to disagree with that. Why do you think there would be a tremendous backlash?
Well, I think there would. Adam and I went on Andrea Mitchell's show and shows you the danger of going on television these days, because 5 minutes before that, Sean Spicer resigned. So this became the issue. I've known Bob Mueller for a long time when I worked in the Justice Department. I think people on both sides of the aisle have tremendous respect for him. I think we should allow him to move forward with this investigation wherever it leads and get to the bottom of this for the American people and then move on, whether there's something there or whether there's nothing. And so I do think it would not, I should maybe backlash, it would not be received well.
Do you actually think you went too far in saying there'd be a tremendous backlash? You think it might be something less than that?
I think it would not be received well because of the respect both sides have for the integrity of Bob Mueller and what he's attempting to do, and not an easy task.
Would Congress do anything if he fired Mueller?
That's going to be one of those hypotheticals that, I think there would be a lot of media attention, obviously.
I want to ask Stephanie first. If the president fired Mueller or took any of the other actions that have been reported this last 48 hours that he's considering, pardoning himself, pardoning his aides, what would and should Congress's reaction be?
As it relates to our oversight role, I don't believe it's necessarily a Democratic or a Republican perspective or that we would act differently. My hope would be that we would act on behalf of the American people and have to look at the actions in the context of how they came about. But I think there's never a more important time than right now for Congress to be very assertive about both its exerting its co-equal branch of government powers. Having worked in the Department of Defense, I find myself a little surprised at how strongly I feel about that now, but they say that your perspective depends on where your seat is. But I do think that our job is to hold the administration accountable, and we do that in a variety of ways.
Adam. Ron, I was going to say, first of all, I look forward to the day when I have the conundrum of being a Democrat in the majority with a Democratic president. That has been all too hypothetical, unfortunately. I think if the president fires Bob Mueller, I think it will be a national disaster. I think it will provoke a crisis, and I would hope that the Congress would come together and immediately pass a new independent counsel law. That wouldn't be one that would be freestanding and go on indefinitely. That would be sunset, and that would be specific to the Russia investigation and would allow the reappointment of Bob Mueller to a position beyond the president's reach. Hmm. I would hope that's what we would do. I can certainly more than understand my colleagues not wanting to delve into this and answer a hypothetical they hope doesn't come to pass, because it would be a terrible thing for the country if it does.
Yeah.
I do worry, and maybe this isn't the best forum for my colleagues to deliver that message publicly to the president, but I hope that they deliver it privately so that that can be avoided, because I really do think then we are in a an existential crisis of our system of checks and balances, because we do have a president who made clear within the last 24 to 48 hours that he has a very different view of the independence of the Justice Department, Special Counsel, Deputy AG, AG, FBI Director, Acting FBI Director, than has been the custom and practice for the President of the United States. And I do think that it is essential that we reassert our dedication to our system of checks and balances. And even though I understand the desire not to confront the president publicly on a hypothetical, I hope that my colleagues will communicate that privately so that we can avoid that kind of a crisis.
Can I say, I mean, oversight when your party is not in power is sometimes easier.
Yeah.
I mean, I'll give you that. But I will also say that my experience with Secretary Kelly has been extremely positive and has given me the opportunity to actually get things done. Yeah. For instance, we passed yesterday in the Congress 386, you know, votes to approve the reauthorization bill of the Department of Homeland Security for the first time since its creation.
With a huge bipartisan majority.
And I do want to thank the Aspen Institute for, you know, constantly supporting this position. It helped tremendously. I worked with seven other chairmen. I worked with the Attorney General, the Secretary of Homeland, and the Democrats to get us to the right place to make this a bipartisan bill, which it has to be, for it to be able to get through the Senate and signed into law. And this is going to protect the American people.
Yeah. Well, this gets to my next question about the relationship between President Trump and foreign policy making in Congress. And I want to read a quote from one of your colleagues, Representative Mike Simpson, a Republican of Idaho. He said on Wednesday, "I don't even pay any attention to what is going on with the administration because I don't care. They're a distraction. The president is a distraction. At first it was, well, yeah, this is the guy we elected. He'll learn. And now you just don't see that happening." Is that a common view among policymakers, especially with respect to foreign policy in Congress? You want to start?
Two things. One is, as we've talked, President Trump has been unique. Let me back up.
Yeah.
All the presidents before, every one of their sentences was carefully thought out. There were advisors. You know, it was weighed. It was policy, and the world could react.
Yeah,
it's different now.
Yeah, sure is.
It's just different. And so that's part of the reason when you and others take statements that he makes, you take them very seriously, start asking us hypotheticals. I'm not sure we take everything he says as weightily as we have presidential statements in the past. What matters is what they do. Now, that we do have to take seriously.
Yeah.
So there is more of a differentiation, if you will, between tweets and statements and seemingly contradictory statements, you know, all of this stuff, versus what the administration actually does. That's what we have to really pay attention to.
Does anyone else want to take this?
I think 140 characters is a tight space to express national security strategy, which is why one of the reasons I led a letter to the president requesting the national security strategy, which is overdue at this point, to Congress. It's important that we understand where the White House is on a lot of these issues. We have a lot of challenges. But in the interim, until we get that clear statement, I think you'll see Congress continuing to move forward and continuing to advance what has been traditionally the policy of the United States. Chairman McCaul mentioned the Homeland Security Bill. Chairman Thornberry, just 2 weeks ago, we passed the National Defense Authorization Act, wherein we put investments into European Deterrence Initiative, put investments into cyber, bolstered our commitment to Asia Pacific. I was proud to work with him on that, and I think, you know, where we put our investments also shows what our priorities are. And then Ranking Member Schiff has been working through the Intelligence Committee to get to the bottom of the Russian interference. So, you know, despite the tweets and somewhat unconventional deployment of national security strategy, the rest of the apparatus are co-equal branches moving forward and continuing to ensure for the national security of this country.
But could there be greater discipline in the communications team? Of course. And now they're going to have a new team coming into place. I hope they can refine the message. The messaging is important. It can be distracting to what we're trying to accomplish. But on the policy level, personality aside, you know, whether it's, you know, Max Bill to increase the might of our military to homeland security issues to intelligence, you know, we're trying to get this healthcare tax reform thing done. Those are the issues the American people really care about.
Can I just, yeah. Ryan, also, let me start out by touting our committee for a moment. We passed a bipartisan intelligence authorization bill out of our committee a week ago, which, you know, notwithstanding how fraught things have been between the chairman and myself, we set that aside and we got our work done, which is what we need to do. I will say, I think, in terms of the presidential statements and our foreign policy, national security policy, I'll give you a quick sense of what I think are the pros and cons. The cons are quite obvious when you have the president cheering on Saudi Arabia's side vis-a-vis Qatar, and you have the Secretary of State trying to do something quite different.
Yeah.
Other countries look and they say, okay, what is the policy of the United States, and aren't really sure what to make of it. That's obviously a problem. On the other hand, as Mac was pointing out, there are some good things happening. And, you know, just today there was a decision made, in my view, the right decision to bring an al-Qaeda suspect for prosecution in a court, not to Gitmo. I think the administration made a very sound decision to arm the Kurds and endure the criticism of the Turks, because the Kurds were among the most capable fighting forces, and you work with who you can work with. And I think the military and administration strategy in Iraq around Mosul has been successful. And so I think that there has been a learning process that has been at times successful, because a lot of these things were campaigned against.
Yeah.
The Obama administration doesn't know what they're doing in Iraq, and they don't know what they're doing in Syria, and they don't know what they're doing with Gitmo. But there have been times where they've looked at it and thought, well, you know, actually, we can make slight changes here, but we were on the right trajectory in Mosul, and we were on the right trajectory in terms of how we were encircling ISIS in Syria. So I think there have been positive actions, even though I do think the dissonance between the presidential statements and the foreign policy national security team have created enormous headaches for the execution of our strategy.
But I think that's a fair point on all of your committees. Work is getting done and isn't necessarily as covered, or doesn't make the front page news. One of the things you talked about was the National Defense Authorization Act. There's language in that, correct me if I'm wrong, but there's language in that on the AUMF. It asks the Pentagon to sort of give a recommendation about what should happen with the AUMF. But correct me if I'm wrong about that, but just in general, I want to ask all of you, what should Congress do about this issue that just seems like Congress has abdicated its responsibility for so long for various reasons? I want to know what each of you think should be done about that.
Okay. Just what is in the bill is a requirement that the administration come to us with a strategy and budget and legal recommendations for an AUMF against the terrorist threat we face today.
And that would sunset the current AUMF?
The idea is now we've got something that would replace the 2001 AUMF that we have been operating under since 4 or 5 days after 9/11.
Yeah.
One other brief correction. In both 2011 and 2012, the House passed an update to the current AUMF. It didn't get much attention. Again, we were trying to go beyond those who committed the attacks of 9/11 and include associated forces with it. We could not convince our Senate colleagues to do so. There was a little detention language that ended up from it. But we've been trying. My guess is every one of us think we need a new AUMF, that we have abrogated our responsibilities under the Constitution by not updating the AUMF to meet the threat that we face now. Adam has specific proposals that ought to be talked about on how we should do that. I'm hopeful. One other point. Yeah. Don't underestimate how hard this is. You had Republicans that would only agree to an AUMF with President Obama if it had all these restrictions on it,
right.
Like you can only go in these countries for this time, no ground troops. Well, that's ridiculous.
Right.
Now we're going to have, we have some of the opposite problem, where people don't press
or
trust
you'll have
President
Democrats
Trump.
Who don't want any AUMF for President Trump.
Yeah. So you do get partisanship bleeding into this, but the effect is Congress has not done its job.
So it's easy just to sort of let things go autopilot.
Unfortunately what's happened, but we ought to... I think we all agree, probably, we ought to fight through what's easy and the partisanship and do the right thing anyway.
Just quickly on the AUMF, I want to hear from each of you.
It has been a bipartisan failure in Congress and in the administration. I think in the last administration, although the president proposed one, he did not want to use his political capital muscle to force one through.
Yeah.
And his view, I think, quite understandably, was I shouldn't want this more than the Congress. It's their institutional responsibility they're giving up.
Right.
And the power to declare war. But now the new administration can rely on the Obama precedent and say, well, we're just following what the last president did, and last president took the legal position. We have all the authority we need. What I think, what I've been suggesting as a way of navigating those red lines that the parties have on it is to have an AUMF that doesn't have a geographic limit, that does have a sunset, because we don't want to be 16 years from now and debating a new AUMF and unable to deal with it, but that would have a mechanism where it wouldn't limit the president's ability to use ground troops, but if the president did introduce ground troops in a combat mission, you would have a privilege motion to compel a vote to approve, repeal, modify the existing AUMF, so we wouldn't go again for over a decade without having that kind of discipline and accountability.
No, I've supported the outlines of what Adam just talked about as far as the AUMF, but I want to talk about another area where I think Congress has abrogated its role that has a significant impact on national security, and that's in the budgeting process. We've been with this BCA and continuing resolutions for quite some time. To the person, every single military person who comes before the House Armed Services Committee has told us what damage that has done to our operational readiness, as well as our ability to invest in the emerging threats areas in a way that creates a smart and strong approach to train, man, and equip for the threats that we're facing today. And so, I think that is something that we have to, as a Congress, take back ownership over. I mean, power of the purse is one of the main powers of Congress, and by allowing this sort of rolling over without making deliberate decisions and prioritization as it relates to how we spend our money, we're abrogating that role, and it's having a negative impact on our national security.
Michael, do you want to add anything on the AUMF?
Well, I'm a senior member on the Foreign Affairs Committee. That's a committee of jurisdiction, and I do believe we've abdicated our responsibilities. The reason I did the reauthorization on Homeland was because we abdicated our Article I responsibilities as a separate branch of government. Mm-hmm. I think, as Mac pointed out, the difficulties was that the former president's AUMF actually limited his abilities to fight ISIS, Al-Qaeda, and its affiliates rather than expand that authority. I would prefer an AUMF that does not rein in the administration's ability to defeat and destroy ISIS and its affiliates, but rather gives broader discretion and capabilities. The one thing, that a lot of people don't talk about this president, but his ability to not micromanage and unleash the generals in Iraq and Syria has expedited this effort to defeat and destroy ISIS. And from a homeland security standpoint, the sooner Raqqa falls, the safer we're going to be in the homeland, because we have a current threat to our aviation sector that I know Secretary Kelly talked about, these laptop devices being turned into explosive devices, which is why I think you're seeing General Mattis really ramping up this effort to defeat them.
That was actually my next question for you, is about laptop devices. Do you think that Congress should step in and maybe do something legislatively on that? Are you that concerned?
Well, we have passed aviation bills, out of my committee to, in fact, the authorization bill has new TSA authorities to help TSA identify these and develop technologies to detect this. I think the biggest threat is that they're able to develop laptop devices just a little bit bigger than your iPhone.
Yeah.
That could be turned into bombs and airplanes. And the question was our detection capabilities. So we authorize and empower that in the authorization bill. Now, the Secretary, as he told you, this imaging technology, I think, has more capabilities to see these explosives devices within the laptop. But it's an ever-evolving threat. They've been focused on aviation ever since Ramzi Youssef and the Bojanka plot before 9/11, and then on 9/11 when he talked to his uncle Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and plotted that horrible event. And Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, relentless in aviation. And now we're seeing ISIS and their ramped-up capabilities like what we saw with Sharm el-Sheikh. And I hope I'm wrong, but it could be a matter of time before an inbound flight flies into Europe, and God forbid it gets in the United States.
One more Homeland Security question that's relevant to your committee and your job. This border wall that seem to be very important to the Trump campaign. Do you support the same version of the border wall that the president has talked about, a full physical wall on the entire border?
You know, it's hard to know exactly what the president wants.
Oh, I know what he wants. He said he's made it very clear. He wants a full physical wall on the southern border.
But then it's modified to a wall with slits so you can see the other side, which is what Border Patrol wants, to a 40-foot concrete wall with solar panels on it.
There's
to change. And so
It's
I have a border security bill I'll be introducing before the end of this Congress. It calls really for three things: physical infrastructure, which includes concrete levees, fencing. Technology, I think, is one of the key elements down there. Yeah. Most cost-effective, efficient ways to get this done. And then additional personnel to respond to that threat. We will be authorizing the Secretary with broad powers to do that. I'm not going to micromanage him and tell him where to do it or how exactly to do it.
But a full physical wall on the entire border is just not going to happen.
Well, I think, Mac, we're from a state that has a river. It's hard to envision that how you could structurally do that.
Well, you just put it on the bank.
Yeah. It works in some places. The concrete levees work well.
Yeah.
It's flood protection. The communities like that. Well-populated areas, physical barricades work. In between there, technology seems to be more effective.
So concrete wall in some places, electronic surveillance sort of barrier in places, and fencing in places. What does that hear you saying?
But it all has to be integrated by technology, which is not being done now.
Okay.
And that's why it's not being effective. Now, having said that, the rhetoric and the deportations have brought the crossings down by 70%. But we do have to reinforce, I think, the border. I think the secretary mentioned one of the greatest threats that we have is the human and drug trafficking coming into the United States and the potential terrorists that are linked to transnational criminal organizations.
Does anyone want to add anything on the wall? No. Final issue I wanted to get to is Section 702 reauthorization. First of all, does everyone on this panel support reauthorization of Section 702?
Yes.
Yeah. Yes.
The president has made an argument, starting with a tweet that President Obama wiretapped him at Trump Tower. That argument then turned into that the Obama administration used Section 702 to do surveillance on its political opponents. This is now a common argument among a certain very vocal part of the political world, that the Obama administration abused this incredibly sensitive power. It all started with President Trump tweeting that. First of all, does anyone on this panel believe that the Obama administration abuse Section 702 to spy on its political opponents? And then the second question is, what has that argument from our president done to your job of getting this reauthorized? Why don't we start with you, Mac?
I disagree with part of the premise of your question.
Okay.
Earlier today, we were talking about cyber and why we have not made more progress in developing the policies to protect the country in cyberspace. Two words, WikiLeaks and Snowden. Hmm. Boehner appointed me to a task force of 9 different committees to lay out a plan for protecting this country against cyber. Now, Michael, a few years ago, got some of that stuff done. But basically what happened is it all came to a screeching halt with the WikiLeaks and Snowden disclosures because everybody got afraid that the government was reading the recipes you were sending your grandma. And it made a coherent discussion about what the government is doing, is not doing, what the threats are, impossible to have. I hope we're kind of getting out of that, but you still have fringes, I would say, on both sides of the political spectrum who use this scare tactic to deny us the ability to not only detect terrorists, but also to do better against some of the cyber threats that we face. So I hope that on a bipartisan basis in the coming year, we can do the responsible thing and reauthorize this particular law, regardless of those tactics that have been going on for a while.
Do you think there's any evidence that the Obama administration abused 702?
The answer, no. Okay. I think there are instances where somebody hit the wrong key, and all of those are fully reported and gone over because every step of this is intensely scrutinized at several levels. This is Adam's bailiwick now, but I don't know of any evidence that there was an intentional abuse of anything.
Well, those two questions, Adam. Evidence of abuse, and has that debate made it more difficult to get 702 authorized?
I haven't seen any evidence of abuse, and I do think you had both the pre-existing concern on the left with our surveillance programs, but then you now have this concern on the right that I think did originate in the president's tweets in a way to try to justify the president's tweets that Obama must have been using 702 to surveil on Donald Trump. There's no evidence of that. 702 is an enormously effective tool. And we had a vigorous debate about the telephone metadata program. That was a far less effective tool, and I think we arrived at a very sensible reform of that. 702 has been much more important in terms of protecting our country, much more important in terms of protecting our allies by uncovering plots against others in Europe and elsewhere. So it needs to be reauthorized. That is going to be more difficult now. I think the legitimate legislative issues, the legitimate areas to examine in terms of reform are questions over the data that we gather when we use 702. And obviously 702 is targeted foreigners on foreign soil. Mm-hmm. Is when we do a U.S. person identifier query of that database. In other words, we get data that we've obtained lawfully surveilling people outside the country. But at times there are queries of that database using a U.S. person identifier, meaning a U.S. phone number, or a U.S. IP address, or a U.S. person's name, or a U.S. business name. Now, there may be very good reasons to do that. If you, for example, see chatter that a particular target terrorist might be focused on, you may want to plumb that database to find out who is talking about that particular target, and that target might be a U.S. location. So the question, I think, is, are there any changes? Are there any reforms? Some are suggesting, well, we should have a warrant requirement. We should require going to court before you can do that U.S. person search. That really doesn't work in the context where that U.S. identifier may be the victim rather than a suspect. So we're going to have to work our way through those issues. It's going to be more complicated, but we will, I think, do the country a great disservice if we don't succeed in reauthorization because it is a vital program.
And I understand the need to, and I support the idea of balancing our national security needs with the civil liberties. I don't think a tweet is necessarily evidence, and I think that we need to make more of our decisions based on data and evidence-based legislating. I will tell you the way that I'm seeing the rhetoric and the misinformation manifest itself in my community, why I'm so concerned. One of the top questions I get when I'm home in the community is, where do you get your information? And that's a legitimate question of, we don't know what to believe anymore.
Yeah.
And I think for a democracy, when your average citizen doesn't feel like they can believe their media, we're in a bad place.
Yeah. Or they're public officials. Yeah.
Or they're public officials. Yeah. And I think that's why it's so important for us to get back to a place where we are legislating from a data-based position, and that we as legislators and public officials are careful with our words because they matter. Words matter.
All right, Mike, I'm going to ask you to hold your thoughts on 702 just so we can get a couple of questions in before
we finish. Well, if I can say just real quick, because I practiced law under Patriot Act and 702, saw the value of that. It stopped a lot of bad things from happening in this country, and I think it would make this country less safe if we do not reauthorize it. And I'm worried because everybody here supports it, but there are a lot of people on the Judiciary Committee, for instance, that will not want to reauthorize this thing.
Republicans and Democrats or...
Right. And, I applied for FISA. If you're an agent of a foreign power, probable cause to get up on a FISA in the United States. But if it's foreign persons in foreign countries with a minimization of U.S. persons.
We have time for a few questions right here on the blue blazer. Yeah. White shirt, blue blazer.
Can you spell it out, I guess? Nick Christensen, Lambert County, Colorado Sheriff's Office and a liaison to our state division. My question is, ISIS continues to use social media to radicalize individuals here in our country. How is this threat evolving, and what can we do in local law enforcement to better partner with our federal partners than they with us?
This is the difference between bin Laden, Al-Qaeda, and al-Baghdadi and ISIS, is the internet. The ability to propaganda, to recruit, train, and radicalize within the United States. It is their most effective weapon that they have. And, we can try to do things at the federal level to, censor that type of information on the internet. But I think the better route is to go with our private tech companies. I know Facebook may have their representative here today, may not want to be called out in person, who monitors this stuff, jihadist material, and then takes it down off the internet. So if they had terms of service agreement with the customer that if you put jihadist material on there, we're going to take it down, that gets around the whole court, debates about First Amendment protections.
Right here.
Hi, my name is Nolly. I'm an ASF scholar. Thank you so much for joining us today and for your service. My question is, can you talk a little bit about the role of humanitarian relief and national security and what Congress can do to promote that and prioritize it in U.S. foreign policy?
Great. Who wants to take that?
I'll take a stab at that. One of the most powerful things that I've seen and congressional delegations are often much maligned, but from my point of view, I don't have any experience in my job where I learn more hour by hour, moment for moment, than when I have a chance to visit our troops in Iraq or Afghanistan or elsewhere. But I remember going to northwest Pakistan, and this was not long after a devastating earthquake there, and seeing the work that USAID had done, and talking to Pakistanis about it. And our military does a lot of things extraordinarily well. One of the things they do, second to none, is the kind of emergency relief after a natural disaster, getting into very hard-to-reach places. Well, when we provided that relief in a part of the world where we are not well-liked, not well-thought of, have a lot of enemies and adversaries, we became heroes. And the Pakistanis told me that in the wake of that, the most popular toy for Pakistani kids was a model of an American helicopter because they saw these copters delivering relief. And so I think that kind of aid is great diplomacy. It's good national security policy. It's great for humanitarian needs. So I think it's something we ought to do a lot more on and really cultivate. You know, the only other thing I'll mention is a similar experience in Pakistan. I represent Caltech and the Jet Propulsion Laboratory. I was there when we had one of the landings on Mars, and that was of just the most unmitigated positive as well. Some of our joint scientific endeavors are enormously popular around the world. They're great diplomacy, and we ought to keep them up. And I would even say, with our Russian partners, even in the worst of the Cold War, we continued Russian-American scientific dialogue, and those you know, back channels of diplomacy are very important.
And like I said, you know, the soft power combined with hard power is the way to do this. And we heard from the commander of SOCOM talking about working with the One campaign, for instance. Adam and I had dinner at the Munich Security Conference with Bill Gates and Bono, which is kind of cool. But it's an example of that kind of partnership, working with NGOs, with things like the One campaign or Gates Foundation to strengthen our abilities over there.
You know, I worked the 2004 tsunami, and I saw much of what Adam mentioned about the benefits of humanitarian relief and disaster, humanitarian assistance and disaster relief in one of the largest Muslim country in the world. But what I would say is that beyond the support for this idea, we have to put money and people behind that. And when the president's budget comes out and it's cutting the State Department diplomacy and development dollars by 30%, and what is bouncing around now in Congress only brings it up to about half of that, you know, that becomes a problem. It limits your ability to execute on those soft power tools. And so I think it's important that we put our money and our people behind what we believe works for this country.
We're out of time. I just have one final quick question. Since President Trump has taken office, is America's standing in the world stronger, weaker, or about the same? Go across and answer that.
My temptation is to say too early to say, although I think we're on a positive trajectory, partly because of what we've been doing.
Adam?
Well, I mean, you can write this off to my party affiliation, but...
My attempt to get a one-word answer on this isn't going to work.
Oh, I'm sorry.
It's fine, though.
Well, I think when we walked out of the Paris Climate Accords, we renounced a significant part of our leadership of the world. And the most troubling headline I've seen during the Trump presidency was when Angela Merkel came to visit Washington the first time. And the headline, and this was before the Paris Agreement withdrawal, the headline was, "Leader of the Free World Meets Donald Trump."
Yeah.
And to me, that was a horribly painful, poignant headline.
Yeah.
My reluctant conclusion is yes, and not irremediably so, but one last point for a very long one-word answer. I found it so striking, that second meeting the president had with Putin, because here he left sitting next to the Japanese prime minister to go sit next to Vladimir Putin. And when I thought about that image, I thought, these are now two of the most isolated leaders in the world. And no wonder they have common interests. And that is not a position the United States should be in.
That is extremely depressing.
Going back to reading signals from the rest of the world, when we talked to European leaders at the Shangri-La dialogue, they expressed the concern to us that the United States would sell out European countries for a closer relationship with Russia. When we talked to Asian partners and allies, they expressed the concern that the United States would sell out Asian countries for a closer relationship with China. I think when you're listening to what your partners and allies are telling you, it's hard to come to the conclusion that America is stronger than where we were.
Well, I think he's put a great national security team together, and that's the one thing that gives me great confidence. I think his meeting in Saudi, his speech was one of his best. I think reassuring NATO when he gave that speech. And so hearkening back to the previous administration, not to get too political, but I felt like our allies no longer trusted us, and our enemies no longer feared us. And the one thing about Trump is I think he's so unpredictable, like the strike in Syria when the Chinese president's sitting next to him, that there is some value to that. And I think the model of leading as a superpower rather than retreating from the world and creating so many hotspots, I think that doctrine of strategic patience is over under this administration.
Thank you, all of you. Thank you very much.